And if you just want to run over with each of them or something, you know, even though you could have to.
Good morning, everyone. We will begin. We'll have this start out as a subcommittee of our subcommittee, since we're a little bit shy of a quorum. But we appreciate Senator Montesanderson being able to be prompt. We want to respect your time and those of the people that are watching us in this viewing audience across the world, or across the building, whichever. I'd like to just say, kind of as we begin, you know, this is the last day that we'll have to really discuss the Commission on Families, or Children and Families, and this is such an important area that we want to make sure that we focus on your ideas on priorities and the potential reductions and those kinds of things. And so if we can spend maybe 20 minutes or so, actually could be less, depending on if there's anybody to listen, but spend maybe 20 minutes or so giving us an overview of the programs, just kind of bringing us up so that we can then move into the overview of the performance measures and then move into our last phase. So if you would proceed.
For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. So, Chair Richardson and members of the committee, I am going to go back to our chart and just do a brief recap of the programmatic areas from yesterday. Then I'm going to ask Carol Weyer and Lynette Patterson, who is our training coordinator for Healthy Start, to come up and talk a little more about the programs, the areas we didn't finish. Thank you.
Okay. And I want to do this because I think it is so important for us to have that sense of what our system is truly about. As you heard on Monday, Partners for Children and Families, really a seven-agency collaboration, works with communities to do community comprehensive planning. The role of the commission is to bring all of those entities and pieces together, and they map what is in their community. So again, each county, every county has an array of both public and private supports. Public agencies, community-based organizations, civic organizations, faith communities, etc. The local plan maps those supports, the network of them, and identifies the strengths, gaps, barriers that exist in the community. And many of our dollars are what I call siloed. They're in particular places designated only for a particular piece. The commission takes the dollars that they receive, they look at the gaps, the barriers, and they try to fill those gaps, at the same time engaging citizens and the communities to invest in what they know is their priority locally. So, what we're trying to do is build those supports 0 to 18 years of age at the community level. However, there are some kids and their families that need more than what the community can provide. Then we get to what we call Healthy Start intensive services for those high-risk families, to relief nurseries who do a phenomenal job with those high-risk families of keeping those children out of foster care. Excellent, excellent rate, 99%. And then we have court-appointed special advocates. Even though the child is in the court system, has been in and out of home placement. That CASA, who by the way is a volunteer, they work as an arm of the court for the best interest of the child. So it's not just what the mother wants, not just what the father wants, not just what maybe the caseworker needs to be. It's what does the child not only want, what does the child need? And then other targeted prevention supports within that community. So that's sort of the second line, but these are our particular programs. And we call them targeted prevention services for those who fall through that community, those community cracks. And then, of course, the line down here talks about the results of kids not getting what they need, rather here at the community level, or through some kind of targeted prevention service. So we know that juvenile crime exists, especially between the hours of 3 and 6 p.m. Kids and their families are faced with issues of mental illness because of meth addiction, drug, alcohol abuse. There is child abuse and neglect, domestic violence when people don't have jobs, when they don't get what they need, when they're stressed, unemployment, addiction, poor health, and of course, issues around poverty. But these are the costs of not doing what we need to do at this particular level. So I just want to make sure, I want to recap, our role is to try to engage the community and leverage those resources that we receive in order to build the supports all along the continuum, 0 to 18 years of age. Any questions about that? Okay. Carol?
Are you sitting there? Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Carol Weyer, Deputy Director of the State Commission. I wanted to talk today briefly about the green services there, the funding that you provide to communities to fill those gaps. Those, we call those locally invested resources, and it's under Section 4 in your budget book. There's a paper on locally invested resources. There are six funding streams that are part of locally invested resources. Currently, there's about $5 million for the biennium for all 36 counties. So these are not enormous sums that we use in our community to leverage a significant amount of dollars. These funds go across the full spectrum from birth through the year through 18 years. You heard counties yesterday talking about how those funds are used and how they leverage additional dollars. I'll give you one or two more examples. In the Tiger Tualatin School District, it was determined that there was a problem with kindergartners who were acting out. The University of Oregon has done some pretty significant research about antisocial behavior, and we know now that if we don't impact antisocial behavior by about the age of 6 or 7, it becomes chronic behavior. And it can't be turned around, and we can expect some pretty negative outcomes, and particularly crime. So Tiger Tualatin School District wanted to implement the First Step program, which is out of the University of Oregon. The commission, the school district didn't have the funds to do it, the full funding, so the commission invested $35,000. The program was extremely successful, and the commission applied for a $2.5 million federal grant to replicate the program throughout Tiger Tualatin School District, Hillsborough, and Beaverton. The grant is ending this spring, and now that has been integrated into those three school districts. So a very effective use of $35,000 of state funding. Another example might be we know that school and parent involvement in schools is essential to children's success. Research is telling us more and more that that's an essential component. There are families that haven't, for that whom that has not been modeled, and who don't participate in schools. A school in Beaverton worked with the commission to implement a program called FAST, Families and Schools Together. And it's a program where families come in the evening, have a meal, participate in some activities, meet the teachers, and begin to develop that relationship with the schools. Those are very important things that happen with some of these funds. Do you have any questions?
Okay. Any questions? Senator Bates.
Well, I'm just intrigued by what you just said about kindergartners acting out and antisocial behavior, because I have to believe you're correct. We can often tell in a year or two of a child's life, unfortunately, because of the environment the child's in, where that child's end up 15, 16, 17 years later. So how do you know your program? I mean, it's a pretty simple intervention at the kindergarten level, hoping to have an effect about crime and antisocial behavior later on. How did you measure that you might have I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but how do you know that actually what you did had an impact?
It's an evidence-based program developed by Hill Walker at the University of Oregon. So we didn't have to do the science. The science has already been done.
Follow up. How did you measure your outcomes? I mean, you said it's been a very successful program. You've had this going now for a couple of years. I mean, you really can't measure, I wouldn't think, till 15 years later. If you have to follow those kids linearly, you had 400 or 500 children you tried to affect. I mean, did you have some early things you looked at, some changes in behavior you looked at, hoping that will have an effect 15 years later?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, the research that was done was, in fact, longitudinal through the University of Oregon and other replications of that. In Washington County, what was done was they were tested on an adaptive, maladaptive scale so that we could tell how their behavior was changing through the intervention, significant changes in that intervention. It's an intervention with the child, with the teacher, and with the parents, and it's, of course, voluntary.
Okay. I don't want to tie you up. We'll talk later.
Okay.
I might just also add the research that I've seen is certainly supporting the need for families, if at all possible, to be together, that the male figure in the home at an early age for the child helps provide an authority figure which transfers and that which we can do to help assure that children have both a male and a female figure in the home will give them the nurturing and the authority figure which can make a difference in the way they react to society later on. Just as an official matter, we'll close our subcommittee meeting and we open our regular subcommittee meeting now that we have sufficient numbers for a quorum. Thank you very much, Carol, for that information.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, I would now like to introduce Marcia Clark, the manager of our business services, and Geralyn Brennan, who is our data and policy analyst, and they're going to go over our progress towards achieving our outcomes through the performance measures of the agency.
Okay. Sheila Baker.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, while they're coming up, I'd just draw your attention to a document that the commission provided. There were a couple questions yesterday of the various commissions asking how much funding they got from the state commission. And so what you have is a little spreadsheet from them that shows by county for each of the funding streams. And there's invariably acronyms on the spreadsheet, but there is a key on the second page to explain that so that you can see by county and by program how many dollars go to each county.
I might also say before we go further to our committee that now we get into the real meat of what this first phase of the budgeting process is all about, in that at the end of today's session we will have concluded our first phase hearings on the Commission on Children and Families. And looking at the first sheet on tab 4, where it gives the various programs and the amount of funding, we're going to be called upon to rank and each of the programs as far as a priority list as compared to all of the other programs that are funded by the Department of Human Services and in the Human Services Subcommittee's realm. And so we're going to be focusing on the performance measures now, also the 10% reduction options, finding out why the commission has placed their recommendations where they have. So feel free to ask any questions that will help in the decisions that will have to be made as far as prioritization for this department. So with that, Marcia and Geralyn.
Okay. Excuse me. Chair Richardson, members of the commission, for the record, my name is Marcia Clark. I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And I have with me today Geralyn Brennan, who is our data analyst, who will help fill in some of the more technical aspects of some of our programs and get to some of the performance measures. What I wanted to say before I get started is that making a difference is what this state commission system is all about. And as you've watched Mickey pace through the different levels of our intervention in the community, these are particularly where our targeted key performance measures reside. You will see that they will affect the green, and we'll be measuring those yellow circles there. But for the past several years, many years actually, the Commission on Children and Families has been measuring outcomes based on some work that we did with Clara Pratt, Dr. Clara Pratt from the Oregon State University College of Health and Human Services Family Policy and Programs. And together, the commission and Dr. Pratt published a series of books called Building Results, From Wellness Goals to Positive Outcomes for Children. So in that, they're basically a primer for performance measurements for local commissions. So in that, they've got their logic models. There's research-based information about how different outcomes fit within their targeted preventions. And it also links that research best practices to our own performance outcomes. So I think what I'd like to do is maybe have Geraldine talk to you a little bit about how these manuals are used locally.
So the Building Results series. I'm sorry. I'm Geraldine Brennan. I'm the data analyst for the Commission on Children and Families. And the way the Building Results series works is that there has been a number of manuals produced. And there are some that just go over the foundations of the best practice, the theory behind supporting children, young children, youth, and parents, as well as supporting the service providers and community. So there's about five different levels that we really approach to looking at improving services and providing the appropriate services to children. And for the local commissions, what they've done is to develop a plan. They actually pulled together a lot of their partners to identify those key areas that really need their targeted attention. And from that, they then apply the flexible funds to the solutions that they feel are the ones that are the most effective for the circumstances that they have that address the highest priorities that they've identified with their partners. These manuals come up with the theory, but it goes beyond the theory. What we've done is structure a set of outcomes that also are broken down by young children, youth, service providers, and community. And then in addition to that, there's actually an appendix of measures that is a resource to identify tools that can be used to measure the outcomes that you're looking for.
Geraldine, may I ask a question? When you refer to the five, are these the five Oregon benchmarks that are listed behind tab 5 in our binder? Or are they different for different communities?
These five are general areas that commissions may choose to. It's a way of organizing information within Building Results. So I'll give you an example. We have in Wallowa County, there was it was identified that they needed to work on getting children ready to learn for kindergarten. And what they actually decided to do for that outcome was to approach all the partners, and they worked with the library and put in place a resource through the library, primarily through the library, who will support the child care providers in increasing the availability of literacy activities in child care. Well, that approach fits into a service provider approach. And so the information that's organized in here may be specific to a program to serve young children, a program to serve youth, or a program to support services or communities. And that's what those five areas are. But within within the plan, what they were looking at was the Oregon benchmark of getting children ready to learn when they enter kindergarten. So that's how they fit together.
Okay.
Is that clear?
If I could just add a little clarity to that, Chair Richardson. The five areas, the actual titles of those five areas that may be a little clearer to understand are strong, nurturing families, healthy, thriving children, positive youth development, educational progress and success, and caring communities and systems. So they are divided in a way by age group, but they more effectively, many of those will reach several age groups.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. I just want to follow up because I am in tab 5. And are those benchmarks that you mention as measurable in our information? Because ours don't match that.
Yeah. In the key performance measures that have been approved by the legislature for the commission to measure, we went through the Oregon benchmarks and picked out some that had strong links. We have many links to Oregon benchmarks, mm-hmm. but these are four or five that apply to our three key performance measures, and we'll tell you as we get into the performance measures how those Oregon benchmarks link to those performance measures.
Okay.
All right. And before we do get into the key performance measures, we'll just talk a little bit about how we use those performance measures. We use them with our local commissions in managing our contracts so that they can measure the success of their programs. We use it to analyze and make adjustments to programs when we need to. We share successful programs between counties and agencies so they can implement and learn from each other. They can use the same programs. They make decisions on funding, resource allocation, and program implementation, and we use them also to set our priorities so we know what's working, what isn't working. And we also use it to identify training and technical assistance needs out in the communities in implementing their local commission plans and picking out which are the best practices and which strategies to measure. Okay, so that brings us, as we go through the tab, if you turn two pages into the tab, you'll see our key performance measures. What you have is an excerpt from our annual report.
Yeah.
From our annual report, which is the full copy of which is located in your appendix. We're going to take them slightly out of order. We would like to, with your permission, refer to key performance measure 2 first. Key performance measure 2 is read, percent of all commission-funded activity outcomes that meet or exceed outcome targets as reported in the Fiscal Monitoring and Outcome Reporting System database in quarter 8 of the biennium. Our database is a web-enabled database that the counties can report their data throughout the year. I am the Oregon benchmarks that this particular key performance measure impacts are improve readiness for school, reduce high school dropout, and increase child care and availability, and reduce child maltreatment. At this particular point in time, we are meeting our targets about close to 90% of the time.
Would you mind explaining who sets the targets, how are they set?
They're set in collaboration. Usually the local commissions are going to work with their providers to set those targets.
Okay, because I see that you have a flat line target,
mm-hmm.
which, and in the bottom graph, we show overall African Americans, Hispanics, and American Indians, and yet the target is a flat line, which would take in an average of middle class Caucasian families, which might be less likely than targeted groups. And so it seems like the targets ought to be specific to those populations that they're trying to reach.
I can speak to that. Mr. Chair, I can speak to that. The high school dropout rate benchmark is set by the Department of Education. And when we presented this graph, one of the reasons we presented the graph was because one of the ways that our commissions address targets such as this is that what they will do is they'll look at what is the overall benchmark target that has been set. So overall, the high school graduation dropout rate or high school dropout rate is set for the entire state's population. But when our communities look at, so how are we going to address reducing high school dropout rate, one of the things they do is then look at for individual schools or maybe the entire county, They look at which populations are the ones that are exceeding the benchmark and which are the ones that are disproportionately represented within that group that is not meeting the benchmark. And so this is an illustration of the fact that as a county, you may look at this and say, if we're going to try to invest our funds on that green line, I would say that we should probably invest them disproportionately to African Americans, Hispanics, or American Indians in our community, because they seem to be the ones that are not attaining the benchmark. And so we will adjust our resources to attend to the specific needs of that population.
Okay. So, I mean, the target really isn't realistic. You know, it reminded me,
right.
I was once at Disneyland with my 9 kids, and 8 of them got, and my wife got back to the car. And I says, hey, we've got 89% of the kids here. We're doing pretty good. We can go now. But we decided not to because the statistics don't really work. And so we're not going to look at an overall average and say, well, most of the kids are doing pretty well. So I really think we need to have targeted outcomes for the
population. There are a number of programs that when they do set a target, for instance, there are a number of programs throughout the state that target Latino youth.
Mm-hmm.
And generally what they will do is they'll establish what the baseline is in the community, or if it's targeted to a specific school, what's the baseline that they're at. And then they'll set a target for what they want to achieve with that program, that effort, based on what the baseline is for that population they're targeting. So they may not choose the statewide target.
Right,
but
you.
Adjust it to who the specific target population is.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mr. Chair, maybe in the way of clarification here, this will help. The first chart, the percent of outcomes that meet or exceed targets, that is the commission's performance measure. The second chart, the high school dropout rate, is not a commission performance measure per se. It's the statewide benchmark measure, but they included it here just as an example of one of the things that they consider when they're calculating their own performance measure.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. The highest numbers of students who drop out in the state are in northeast Portland. Highest in the state.
And so that's where we need to be focusing
right.
Very closely.
And I think that that's pretty indicative of what these folks are saying here today. It would appear to me I think Governor Attia put something into place that none of us have forgotten. If it's not broken, don't fix it. And I think that you go to where the highest risk factors are to try to bring those down.
Absolutely. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. As Geraldine had mentioned, that this, if you're going to work on that targeted prevention line, these are the targets that actually measure the local investments that we've been talking about that we talked about yesterday and we talked about again this morning. So the locally invested funds are the funds that are invested into the communities, and we measure those through these outcomes. And now I'm going to turn it back again to Geraldine to give you some specific outcomes on some specific programs so that you have kind of an idea of what some of the communities are measuring.
Okay. Because we spent some time on youth, Mr. Chair and other members, I'd like to continue with that idea, although there are many other areas that are served with the flexible funds. But there are three programs that I have information for right here, and all of them are intended to address children at risk and improve their outcomes. One of them in Clackamas County is a program that has two approaches: U-turns, alternatives to suspension, and spice of life. There are gender-specific approaches, two different gender-specific approaches for a population. And the spice of life is a drug and alcohol education and a life skills training. They provide job training, and it focuses on community service, volunteering, and positive activities for girls who are at risk of suspension or expulsion. Okay, so that's the girls' program. The U-turns, alternatives to suspension is the program that is specific to the boys, and it provides study skills, coaching, and activities that enhance basic academic skills, and they address behaviors that result in suspension or expulsion for at-risk youth. For both of these programs, they have two specific approaches for the two different targeted populations, but for both of them, they are measuring referrals or suspensions for delinquent behavior. And this program found that 86% of the participants were free from referrals or suspensions for delinquent behavior for both programs rolled up in quarter two, and then 83% and 80% free from referrals in quarters four and quarter six.
Okay, would you mind explaining the reason that you were unable to meet the performance measure?
No, this actually, they actually did meet the performance measure. Let me go back. That when we do these, set these outcomes, there is a target. This performance measure is the percent of outcomes that meet or exceed the targets. Their target was less than 80%. They wanted to have 75% or more of those kids who are participating in these programs to be free from referrals. So they actually met their target. Their target was 75%. So that's an example. That is that clear? Yes.
Was there any type of a base? What are we comparing the performance to? Was there studies that showed before these kids had this intervention, the number of times they were suspended or referred? Or
in this program, they actually use the school records. So what they've done is they target the children who've been referred because of issues that they have with referrals or possible suspensions, detentions. And so the school is the one who's identifying those children and referring them to the program. And then what's happening is they're looking at, is there an improvement once they begin this program and go through the program, is there an improvement in that child's behavior within the schools? So that's really what they're looking at.
Okay. Well, but what's the baseline that they're comparing the results to show whether there's an improvement?
To the child's previous behavior before they started. It's a pre- and post-program assessment. So if the child is one who's been referred on a regular basis to school, then what they will be looking for is how long that child, once they're engaged in the program, is that child continuing to have to be referred for detentions or other behavior issues.
Sheila, would you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, and Jerry Lynn, I think the question that the chair was asking was not on the individual example, but on the overall measure for the commission. If you look at the last two biennia, overall, the data has not met the target. And so the question is not in an individual program, but on overall for the system as a whole, what are the reasons for the discrepancies in not being able to meet the target?
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Mr. Chair, that we have done a number of reviews of data, and we've done we started a quality improvement project with local commissions, and there's a number of reasons that we have not reached that target level, and they're varied, but I'll give you a few of them. There are a wide variety of programs, and we have not always had success in determining what is a reasonable target or targets that are time-bound. So there may be a target that is set, but when it comes to actually measuring it, it cannot be measured within the time frame that we need to report it. So there's been a number of challenges that we're working on and that we'll have to be working with the local commissions, because all those performance measures need to meet a certain set of criteria. They need to be specific measures that have to be measurable within the time frame, within quarter eight, and they have to be reasonable targets. Sometimes the there's difficulties in setting, identifying what a reasonable target is.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Having worked with Clackamas County and being a part of the Commission on Children and Families during the early 90s, mid-90s, what we were finding, too, although I'm sure they're much better than they were back then, is a lot of these performance measures, when you're dealing with these kinds of children, it usually takes 5 to 10 years to start seeing a difference. And that's what's so hard here when, you know, you're reporting every year to the commission and wanting to see changes. So it's sort of a complex, difficult thing when you're trying to measure behaviors.
Okay. Let's continue, please.
Okay. Okay. Gerilyn, did you have other examples of this particular performance measure that you wanted to?
I have an example of one of those situations when we have an activity that we cannot quite get the data for yet. And I have a couple of those examples. So, in Jefferson County, they have a program called Effective Behavioral Support. This is another program that is actually supporting child care providers by training child care providers on a consistent method of disciplining and providing a positive environment for children that makes them more prepared to enter kindergarten. Well, that particular program, because it addresses preschools, has to be conducted during the school year. And then once the school year is over, then they can go back in and assess how well that program worked for the preschools. But that means that we have to wait all the way through June for it to be over and then do a retrospective assessment to see, once the training was done in those preschools that implemented it, were the results that we were targeting actually attained. And that requires some of that time that is missed when we have to report within a certain time frame.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Chair Richard.
Mickey, I think one of the things that should take place, you have Dr. Henry and I think Dr. White, was it yesterday, from the American Institute?
Dr. Wright.
I think in framing your presentations for the future, you might be able to frame it in a way that we are doing a 10-year study and we're at the fifth year, and my presentation to you has to do with the fifth year. And otherwise, we're going to keep asking these tough questions. And one of the faults I find of this whole situation is that we didn't even give you a chance to do much because we changed the damn program 3 times within a 7-year period of time. And so it doesn't give them any chance to have data that's going to significantly make a difference. And that's the part of the legislature when we get so short-sighted that we don't give programs a chance to give us full and completed data about what they're doing with our children. And so I think it is very important that you, in making your presentation and with Dr. Henry and others, to frame it in such a way that the legislature will know that we cannot give you completed data in less than at least a minimum of 10-year period of time, but we're giving you the data along the line in terms of our fifth-year study. And so that comes up to you guys doing that for us the next time, so people will understand that you have not completed your study. You're just in the midst, not even in the middle, in the midst of your study, right, and how long you think that study range is.
Okay.
Chair Richardson and Senator Carter, thank you very much for making that point. This is the very issue we have been struggling with for the last 10 days in terms of how exactly do we frame this, because we don't as yet have all the information that we need based upon the reporting periods.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Mr. Chair, one thing that I would like to ask, as you make the presentation to specific programs, that you help us understand within which program it is being administered? For instance, with this program that you last spoke in Jefferson County, is it in the Great Start or the Children, Youth, and Families? Where within that is it, so we can identify what part of the budget it fits?
Oh, Representative Hanna, the effective behavioral support was within the Child Care Development Fund.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Okay. And unless there's any further questions about performance measure 2.
Representative Henson.
Well, just a very quick comment, and that's this database is for quarter 8 of the biennium. As we move forward to doing more and more, basing more and more of our budget work based on these outcomes, if your measurements all come from the 8th quarter, we're always working 2 years behind, because we go home after the 7th, if we're lucky. so I would hope there'd be an opportunity at some point to get that into the 6th quarter, so we're looking at the most current information rather than always having to make budget decisions based on the biennium behind.
We would agree with you, and Representative Chair Richardson and Representative Hanson, we would agree that the target or the date, the period needs to be when you can deal with the information when you're here. And I think what we would need to do is request a change to our performance measure at that point. So we can do that certainly before the session is over.
So every time you change a performance measure, you start your period over again, unless you have data that can easily be plugged in.
Exactly.
So
that's also a point. A good point.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So we will now refer to Performance Measure 1. Performance Measure 1, we spoke to a little bit yesterday. It's the incidence rate of child maltreatment. It's lower for children aged 0 to 2 years participating in Healthy Start than for non-served families in the same county. The benchmark that this reaches out to, of course, is child maltreatment. The other one that it strongly influences is children are ready for school. And I'm, at this point, going to ask a couple of folks to join us at the table so that they can talk to you in more depth about what these measurements mean. We have with us Beth Green from the NPC Research, who is our outside evaluator for Healthy Start. And she's going to speak to us about not only the child abuse outcome, but also other outcomes that are measured within Healthy Start. The other person that I'd like to introduce is Lynette Patterson. Lynette Patterson is our training coordinator for Healthy Start, and she's going to talk to you about the effect that Healthy Start has on families in a long term, beyond 0 to 2.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Beth Green. I'm the Vice President of NPC Research, and I'm the lead evaluator for the statewide Healthy Start evaluation. I was asked today to come and talk a little bit about the outcomes for Healthy Start from our 0304, our most recent status report, and highlight some of the key findings for you and answer any questions that you have. First, I know you've received some materials, but one of the key findings from our status report, which is consistent with findings from prior years, is that families who are served by Healthy Start with children who are ages 0 to 2 have about half the rate of child maltreatment compared to children ages 0 to 2 who were not served by Healthy Start. It's a difference of a rate of about 12 per thousand among Healthy Start children and 20 per thousand among children not served by Healthy Start. Now, what this means, essentially, is that Healthy Start has reduced the rate of maltreatment by about 40%. Now, when you look overall at the percentage of children who are free from maltreatment, you see what looks like a smaller difference, from 98% free from maltreatment among non-Healthy Start children to 98.8% free from maltreatment among Healthy Start children, which seems like a small difference. But essentially what this means is if you had a program that completely eliminated child maltreatment, you would only be talking about an increase from 98% to 100%, so there would only be a 2% increase. We've increased that free from maltreatment by 0.8%, which is almost half of the existing cases of maltreatment. Another way to look at this is that among non-Healthy Start children, there were about 2,200 victims of child maltreatment in that age range in that year. If Healthy Start had been able to serve those children, and reduced the rate by 40%, there would have been 1,300 children who were not maltreated. These were unable to be served by Healthy Start, however, because of funding issues. Research estimates that there's a lifetime cost per child abuse case of upwards of $25,000. This is because child abuse is so strongly associated with negative long-term outcomes such as school failure, criminality, and substance abuse. So if you multiply, if you did the math and you imagined what Healthy Start could do among the non-served children, this would amount to a lifetime cost savings for each of those victims. 1,300 victims times $25,000, $33 million. So that's just another way to put that figure in perspective for you. The rate of child maltreatment among Healthy Start children is especially compelling when you consider that Healthy Start does serve a higher risk population than you see in the general population. About 60% of the families screened by Healthy Start had at least one risk factor for poor child outcomes. We know that risk factors such as single parenting, substance abuse, and poverty are strongly associated with child maltreatment. And in the Healthy Start population, we see, for example, the rates of single parenting at about 50% among all families served by Healthy Start, not even looking at the intensive service, the most high-risk group, but among all families who are served by Healthy Start, 50% are single parents. About 5% report self-report substance abuse, and about 40% report financial difficulties. So we are targeting a higher risk population. So the fact that even among this higher risk population, you see a rate of child abuse of only 12 per thousand is really quite remarkable. The other thing to note about the child maltreatment rates is that oftentimes in these kind of early intervention and prevention programs, because you have someone in contact with these high-risk families who's a mandated reporter, oftentimes in those programs you actually see the rates of maltreatment increase because there's someone in the home who wouldn't otherwise be there who can make those child maltreatment reports.
Okay, just
so,
please.
Yes.
Senator Bates.
Yes.
Thank you. Do you want to take questions as we go through the testimony?
I think we should.
That's fine, yes. Chair Richardson. Senator Bates.
And when I look at these things, I always think of what Mark Twain said. There's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics.
Yes.
Okay. We've heard that before. You started to comment on the area I'm most concerned about, and that's the discussion of what the non-served families look like. You kind of went there and away from it. My anecdotal evidence from my personal experience is that non-served families fall in two very broad groups. One is very functional families that, mm-hmm. that you don't serve because clearly there's not any risk factors, and while child abuse certainly can occur in those families, it's less likely.
That's right.
Then you have a group which you're serving, which I think you're doing an exemplary job in. But there's a third group that I'm very concerned about, mm-hmm. and I think the statistics may be pointing to that group. This is a group that you don't serve because they don't want to be served.
Mm-hmm.
And the child abuse in those areas is extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at these figures on child abuse going up and down through 9903, there's something apparently happening in those groups that we don't know about. The rate is going up and down quite a bit. Maybe it's not being reported or is unknown. Maybe there's an intervention going on somewhere, but can you give us some idea of what the, mm-hmm. the high-risk, non-served family looks like, and how can we get to those people and help them?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I can try to answer that question. Of course, because they're not served, we don't have much data about them.
I just want to interrupt. If you could just focus on this, it's an important question, but it's not related to the priority. It's prioritization of the programs that are actually the subject of the committee. But so I just don't want to go too far away from
what
we're trying to accomplish
today. I can give a
quick
answer. Yeah. One of the reasons why the non-serve rate fluctuates a lot is because the number of families in the served group has fluctuated a lot and has actually expanded. Healthy Start served more children, over 10,000 children, this year. And since they tend to target their screenings at higher risk populations, we're tending to get more and more high risk families in the served population. So that can account for the fluctuation in the non-served population. We get about, this year was the first year that we collected data on families who
decline to participate in Healthy Start from the very initial contact. And about 20% of families did decline. And we don't know if those families are those high-functioning families. My guess is that you're right. They're high-functioning and some of the extremely high-risk families that are in there. Does that answer your question at all?
It confirms my suspicions. Mr. Chair, in all due respect, this is extremely important for me for prioritizing because it gives me information that says, do I put more in Head Start and less somewhere else in its programs? And what is an effective program, what isn't? What we're trying to do here is reduce, child mistreatment and neglect. And I want to know about those high-risk families and how we get to them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get to them for us? Can another part of the program get to them for us? Okay. That's the answers I need in order for my own prioritization to occur.
Okay. Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, the other thing I want to add is that we do know that about 2,700 children, families, were identified with at least one risk factor, making them potentially eligible for the intensive home visiting services. But because of resource constraints, we were unable to do further assessment on those families to identify whether or not they were eligible. So that's a considerable number of families, 2,700.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That sort of ends my discussion of the child maltreatment outcomes. I want to move to talking about two other areas that we measure in Healthy Start related to the school readiness benchmark. Of course, when you're talking about 0 to 3-year-olds, all risk factors for all three of those are highly related. We look at two dimensions which are were put forward by the National Education Goals Panel that relate strongly to school readiness. The first is health and healthy development of children. And what we find when we look at Healthy Start children, and here I'm referring to the families who are receiving the intensive home visiting services, we found that 92% of these very high-risk children were fully immunized by age 2. The statewide rate in Oregon for 2-year-olds is about 72%, so that compares quite favorably to the overall rate, especially when you consider that Healthy Start is serving a higher risk population. About 91% of Healthy Start's children were receiving regular well baby preventive checkups, which is, of course, very important in reducing long-term health care costs.
Can I interrupt just for a moment? I don't know if you can answer this, but maybe someone there. Are there other programs that you're aware of that are also doing home visits and that are doing essentially the same or similar things as Healthy Start is doing?
In Oregon, in addition to Healthy Start, there are other programs such as Early Head Start that do home visiting services. The Nurse Family Partnership Program does home visiting services.
What was the second one?
The David Olds Nurse Family Partnership Program.
Okay.
It's in Multnomah County. And those programs, I'm not familiar with the results for Oregon specifically, but have been found to have positive outcomes, especially the David Olds program has been very well researched.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. And Mickey, when you come back, could you talk to us about the collaboration, or if there is such, between the federal Head Start program and your program?
Thank you.
Okay, sure. To continue on, just a couple more points I want to add. So 91% of Healthy Start children had well baby checkups. That compares favorably to 84% nationally. 94% of Healthy Start children had health insurance coverage compared to 85% nationally. And again, talking about a 10% difference, but the national figures represent the general population, whereas the Healthy Start figures represent rates among a high-risk population. So those figures are fairly compelling.
Would you mind defining, you said that 91% has health insurance?
No, 94% had health insurance coverage of some sort.
So what is the relationship between Healthy Start and people having health insurance?
One of the things that Healthy Start home visitors do is to try to connect families with resources such as health insurance, WIC, other services for families who lack those services.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hannah.
Thank you. There's a piece that we got earlier, and there's a statement in there, and it relates to the health insurance that says, a 78% decrease in the number of families needing health insurance. Mm-hmm. Help me understand.
Yes, Chair Richardson, Senator, Representative Hannah, what we do is we look at when the family comes into the program and whether there's a need for health insurance. Is the family uninsured? And then the worker the goal of the worker would be to link the family up with appropriate health insurance services. We then reassess after 6 months or 12 months in the program to see whether the family is still in need of that service or whether that need has been met. So that's why the reduction in
we're
need.
We're talking about health insurance or health coverage?
Health insurance coverage. So is mostly
health insurance. Normally you think there's an insurance company and there's premiums being paid.
No, Healthy Start does not pay for health insurance. It helps the family to get linked
to health coverage, so they have health benefits.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So it's 77% of intensive service families are on OHP, for example.
All right.
Can I follow up? Sorry, I want to understand. I think we're getting close here.
Okay.
Is that really, you're not talking about somebody, a caseworker, meeting with the family and getting them on an indemnity-style health insurance where they're paying a premium.
No.
You're putting them towards a given program, be it Oregon Health Plan or...
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct, yes. I'm looking at Lynette. She's more
Mr.
of a program
Chair,
person.
Send me back to kind of what we're talking about before. Most of these people are already on OHP because they were signed up in the hospital when they had the delivery. Okay, and some of them are probably picked up on this program but didn't somehow get signed up. Mm-hmm. The question is what kind of populations you're comparing here, and that's what I was trying to get to. You're comparing it to a general population. It's interesting that people in this program have a higher coverage for health insurance because of Medicaid than the general population. So you're comparing to a population which, in many cases, because the parents make too much money, don't have health insurance, while this group, which is at higher risk, in fact, has better access to health care. So it's a very mixed bag of things here, and I'm still going back to my original concerns that we're comparing apples and oranges. I would much rather see a comparison of this program against high-risk families and not what you're doing, which the only thing you can do is a general population. I mean, it's very difficult to get good figures out of this to figure out whether you're making the impact you really want. And especially when I see that you haven't had any change in your population group for 5 years. You haven't reduced inside that group any.
Yeah, Chair Richardson.
Held to a certain level but not dropped it any lower.
When you look where the statistics are available for higher risk populations, and primarily that's looking at poverty. So if you look at a poverty population, you see much lower rates than what you see in the general population. So if the general population rate for health insurance is 85%. The rate for persons living in poverty is 76%. I'm making that up because I don't know the figure off the top of my head. But consistently for families living in poverty, these kinds of indicators are lower than the national average. Because when you look at the national average, you're considering all families, including very high-functioning middle-class and upper-middle-class families. So you are comparing apples and oranges. But given that, it's amazing that Healthy Start families are doing better than general population statistics. They're doing far better than other families living in poverty, and other minority families is the other group that you can usually find data for.
We're also dealing with an age group, because these people are having children, and there's a lot of people in the general population that are no longer having children, and so people at this age group are usually not making as much money as they might be 20 years later, and there's lots of factors that would interfere.
Chair Richardson, yes, and that's why all the statistics that we compare to are for families with children 0 to 3, which is the primary Healthy Start population, even though some programs serve 0 to 5. So we make sure and control for that.
Right.
I just want to add one more finding because I think it's an important one, which is that parents of Healthy Start children reported reading to their children on a daily basis, 66% of families, which at first when I saw that, I thought, well, that's not very many. The national average is about 50%. Among poor families, it's about 40%. When you look at, for example, Early Head Start, which had a very large research study, they found significant differences for Early Head Start families, but they still only found about 50% of families who are reading to their very young children on a daily basis. We know that reading to young children is one of the strongest predictors of cognitive development and later school success. So that finding I thought was particularly impressive. I wanted to bring it to your attention. I think at that point I'm finished with my presentation. If you have any questions, I'm glad to take them.
Questions on performance measure number one? No, thank you. We have one more performance measure, and then we go into our 10%.
Actually, Chair Richardson, if we could have an opportunity for Lynette to talk to you a little bit about the impact on families of this first benchmark.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'm Lynette Patterson. I am a Healthy Start staff person for the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, and I want to thank you. I will take only about 5 minutes. And what I want to talk to you about is the greater impact of Healthy Start on families and children. And we all know that child abuse prevention, child abuse and neglect and maltreatment is critical in reducing the number of children that are victimized by child abuse is critical. And I want to focus on the greater picture of Healthy Start. When I talk with new staff into Healthy Start, or when I talk with new parents that want to know about Healthy Start, I talk to them about Healthy Start being a support that is there to help them build strong, healthy families and what that means. And on a big picture sense, we kind of define that into three areas that we look at in working with families. We look at the growth and development of the child and some of the statistics and outcomes that you just saw around that. We put that in outcome measure language around immunizations, well, child checks, that kind of thing. We talk about building strong, healthy families through creating positive parent-child interactions and positive parent-child relationships and what that means. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what that means. But the third thing we focus in on is really enhancing family functioning and what that means and looks like in a family. And that includes trust building. It includes problem-solving skills. It includes connecting families with support systems. So what I'd like to focus in on is we recognize that Healthy Start is a wellness model. We operate on the principle that all babies have a right to be loved and nurtured. And we also recognize that not all families are created equal and that not all of us as parents have the same knowledge level, skill level, past experiences to be able to parent in a real positive, loving, nurturing way. So when we talk to families about parent-child interaction, developing healthy parent-child relationships, if you'll think about that parent-child interaction piece as those interactions, and those of you that are parents or have a young child that you have been close to, those interactions have a cumulative effect. They build to ultimately develop some relationships. In Healthy Start, what we look for is providing opportunities for parents to make the most out of those moments. We look for teachable moments when we can support that family, that parent, that mom, that dad, to make the most out of that interaction. And in real simplistic terms, we help the parent look that with every interaction, you've got a behavior from the baby, and then you have a response from the parent. That creates a feeling level in that child, and ultimately a message to that child. And if that baby cries, and mom or dad is responsive and picks up that baby, then that baby feels nurtured, feels loved, feels secured, maybe feels a basic need has been taken care of. Overall message to that baby is, I'm valued, I'm cared for, I'm nurtured. Same scenario, baby cries, mom or dad doesn't respond, is not attentive to the baby's needs, and the baby's feeling is a helplessness, a loss of what's going to happen, who's going to be out there to take care of my need, maybe some anger, maybe some feelings of fear. So the ultimate message is my abilities to communicate are not being met. My needs are not being met. And I'm not important and I'm not valued. Now, where that feels in that long term of things is that that creates a sense of self for the child, who and what he is, a sense of the world, who is out there, what can I expect from the world, who can I count on, and a sense of trust. who will be there to respond and take care of my needs. So that, in the final summarization, is developing a sense for future foundations. We've had a lot of information and numbers around outcomes and measures. We know there is solid research out there that shows the critical piece of attachment, bonding, brain development, all of those impacts around a child's later success, success in school and success in life.
Okay, thank you. We really do need to move ahead. I appreciate what you say. We love children. This group loves children, and we know that they need to be taken care of. But we also have to get through a whole bunch of things, and we have less than an hour to do it.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come and give us your presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, our last performance measure is on leveraging, and leveraging is what the Commission on Children and Families does pretty darn well, I think. In the fiscal year, or the biennium ending 03, the commission system leveraged $33 million with the funds that were given them from the state commission, which is very close to a 3-to-1 relationship. These funds are used to invest in the programs that help to meet the benchmark, or the key performance measure 1, and key performance measure 2, and many, many other outcomes that we measure throughout our system to determine effectiveness of our programs. Those funds are received through donations from County General Fund, donations from private and public foundations, federal grants. There's a category that you'll notice on your chart called miscellaneous, and that miscellaneous category is really there to grab a hold of anything that doesn't quite fit within County General Fund donations, private grants, and in-kind contributions. They would be something similar to a local commission funds a provider with $25,000 of commission funds, and the provider then takes that $25,000 and is able to leverage that in the community for an additional, say, $75,000. Or it is also a place where one of our communities has received some county funds that's not County General Fund, but it is funds that they've used to fund a preschool program in their community. So that's would be located. Those are the kinds of things that would be reflected in that miscellaneous column.
Last question. As you determine this number, is this based on putting a value for volunteer hours or
absolutely
hard dollars?
Not. This is hard dollars. Volunteer hours are referenced on the outcome measure there, but they are not included in the total.
Okay, thank you.
And I regrettably... Oh, actually, yes. Mickey just reminded me that relief nurseries and CASA leveraging is also not included in this number. They're reported through a different system.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
I'm not sure where you want to take this line of questioning. To me, these are inputs, and I want to know outcomes. I want to talk about
high school
dropout rate.
I want to talk about
child abuse. I want to talk about time in foster care. I want to talk about adoption rates. I want the actual outcomes, not inputs. And I think co-chairs are heading that direction. I'm not sure how you feel
about
this.
I'm looking at the time because we need to make sure we have time to discuss your 10%, the justification for 10% cuts, and we're out of time in 47 minutes. And so how is this performance measure benefiting the people? I mean, you know, what are the outcomes that that this money really means?
The way that this impacts people is that the communities are taking that and using it with the state commission dollars to invest in programs that are that are in that sort of preventive and targeted prevention level. Their outcomes are reported through our database, which were reflected in the performance measure 2 meeting targets. We can get more information, more detailed information for you on specific performance measures, or actually specific outcomes. The 3 performance measures that the commission is required to report on is a high-level summary, and a high-level summary of actual outcomes that the commission system does generate.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, if I could just break in here. We, I'm trying to think, 2 years ago was it that we went through that process, maybe three, but these benchmarks or these performance measurements were determined by a group of agency people working with the Oregon Progress Board on what makes sense based upon the work you do in your agency to report on. Because of the mobilizing of communities, the dollars that come to local commissions, what this particular performance measure is saying is that we are leveraging this many dollars, additional dollars, to provide services and supports to kids and their families 0 to 18 years of age, determined by that local community. Now, it relates back then to the performance measure number two about when we leverage those dollars, where do they go? How are they used? What kind of outcomes are we getting? Are kids and their families better off because we have done all of this particular work?
Okay. You know what? I think that our time will be best used in the time we have remaining to go to the program priority list and the 10% reduction options. And we'd like to know if we could have Mr. Yunker come forward and with Mickey and Marcia, if we can discuss why you've ranked where you have as far as the 10% list. I'd like to have you deal also with why you put juvenile crime prevention so low on the priority list. And so if I can just now turn that over to you, and if we can use the time to really get into why you, who know the program best, are making the recommendations to us that you are, which are ultimately those that we're going to have to take into consideration as we do prioritization. Mr. Yunker.
Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm John Yunker, and I serve on the State Commission. I'm just going to give you just a very brief summary of how we got to this list, and then I'm going to let our staff, who can get into the details more with you. You're going to hear this from every agency to some extent as you go through this, but first of all, I think we're all well aware we've taken, because of fiscal issues, we've taken this severe or several cuts over the last, 3 years or more, and that's just where the state fiscal situation is, and all of our programs, all of state programs have gone through that issue. So when we looked at looking at additional reductions from the governor's recommended budget, we brought everybody back into the room, all the program, all the direct program, all the community people, all of the other support agencies such as DHS. They were all invited back into this process because we are part of a much, as you can tell, a much bigger process that has to stay coordinated and connected. That group, believe it or not, worked very well together. They do understand each other's programs. They do understand each other's issues. They do understand what each of those programs has gone through in the last 3 years. What they came up with then was our basic guidelines were, you know, where do we get the biggest or best outcomes for the additional dollar? You know, what are the most prudent investments? What is the fabric of our safety net that if we reduce much beyond that, we will start having serious infrastructure issues as far as being able to provide services within the communities? We looked at what kind of reductions those programs had taken in the past. Some had taken more reductions than others. And there were a couple of other agreed-upon things that the group went back and looked at, the economic impact on the communities, those kinds of things. If you look at the 10% reduction list, you'll see, for example, that the court-appointed program there only is taking in general fund recommended about a 2% or so reduction when we knew we had to get the total group had to come up with 10% overall. That was saying a couple of things. One, that program is its outcomes have done very well and that it is stretched very, very thin. And the group as a whole, which meant that more was going to come out of their programs rather than the appointed program, supported a very small reduction in that area. They also looked at, again, then the basic fabric, which is your community basic capacity programs, for example, and said that those areas were very thin already and had taken significant reductions, and the group as a whole said that that area should take about a 5% reduction in general fund. And they went through each of the programs along those lines. Well, then you get to the other end. Well, if we're going to do this, where are we going to have to take more than 10%? And the two areas, based on where they were in the program, how much flexibility they would still have, and would they still be productive, and had they taken additional cuts or not in the past, were Healthy Start, taking, I think, a recommended number of about 15% in general fund. And, of course, there's a lot of dollars there, so 15% in that area makes up for only a 2% reduction in a much smaller area. And the other area was in relief nurseries, and the group believed that the relief nursery program was very successful and very critical to the community, but it had taken less of some cuts in the past, and it had some other support that it could find. And that's basically it. It is never easy going through that process, and it's never perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but we did reach consensus.
Okay. On your prioritization, can you give us some idea of the criteria that you used in determining what was going to be a level one and what would be a level two or three? I mean, what criteria?
Well, I'll turn this over at this point.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, I cannot tell you when you are dealing with a system that is made up of both systems pieces and program pieces how difficult this is in terms of really trying to prioritize. But what we ended up doing was really developing what we called clusters based upon criteria that we absolutely, number one, wanted to keep the commission system viable. That was essential. So if you look at the original four priorities, we clustered those. What are those dollars that go to local communities where local communities can make decisions about, again, what they need along that green line? And I'm going to tell you here, the juvenile crime prevention funds really should be in that number one priority, because those are funds that go out to local communities where they make decisions based upon parameters, but make decisions where those funds actually go. I'm just going to say this quickly. We had some difficulty. This was something that happened very quickly in terms of these dollars moving into our budget. We were not sure exactly how this was going to happen, what we were going to do. We did not give it the same level. We did not address these funds at the same level as we did other things. But what I'm just going to say to you honestly, we need to move those up to number one because those are funds that go to local communities so that we cover the continuum, 0 to 18 years of age. So even though the program areas are number two, that doesn't mean that they are less of a priority. But if we don't have this system in place, we are not able to leverage the kind of community support and funds that we do. That's why those funding streams that have to do with local decision making and keeping the system viable are so critical. Each one of our program areas provides a critical component. As John said, Healthy Start has been more than 50% of our general fund budget. That is the place that has taken the greatest percentage reduction because of that. Because, again, we need to keep the system viable.
Okay, may I interrupt? I started this, so it's my fault, but we're kind of going back and forth between the priorities and reductions. And so if we could just spend a minute on the priorities, like you have Healthy Start as a priority two, and you have Great Start as priority one, and one of the criteria that you used, which I certainly understand, is keep the commission operational. And so that I see. Are there other criteria that you used in determining what would be a number one priority versus a number two or a number three or a number five?
Well, if I may, Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I think the committee worked very hard on this. It was a blend of program folks and local community folks and state staff and commission members who sat at the table and thought, what is it that we need to do? How can we make this system work if we face additional cuts? The first priority, the way they took in the first priority is one of the criteria was, yes, what is locally invested? So there is in there some basic capacity dollars that fund the commission system locally. So funds their staff to do the community mobilization, to do the monitoring and the accountability of the programs that are in the system. The other funds that you see there, Children, Youth, and Families, Great Start, they are the funds that communities use to leverage. So they thought, well, one of their priorities were if we reduce the amount of dollars that we can use to leverage, then we're also going to reduce that leverage. So that was one of the main criteria in that particular place. It was very difficult to prioritize programs against systems, but the committee also thought that the programs had avenues to other resources that the system didn't, if that makes sense. So that's how we came up with those priorities one and two.
Okay, so
does that
basically local investment of funds is certainly important, and then you're dealing with people from throughout the system, and so you had to reach kind of a consensus as you're discussing various programs and so forth.
Yes. Mr. Chair, do any of these general funds, are they used for a match from the federal government?
Chair Richardson, Senator Montanez Anderson, we were doing a brief scan of the system, and there are a few dollars locally that are used to match federal grants, but we would like to have a little more time to really access our partners and ask them a more clarifying question about how many dollars those are used. The sense is that there are a few.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, here's where we're at. We do use a certain amount of our general fund to match maintenance of effort for the Department of Human Services. We also have to make sure that a certain amount of the general fund is free as we send it to local communities so that they can use it as match, so that we don't get into a problem with that. What we are doing now, though, is we are doing a thorough analysis of exactly how much we have, how much is used for maintenance of effort, how much the counties are using locally, how much do we need to keep free for them, again, for their local decision making, and what else can we do to leverage other funds with Department of Human Resources for other kinds of things?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make a comment and then ask a question. The comment is, I don't think that we as a committee are a whole lot smarter than you as a commission, and that's just No disrespect, but it seems like you've put a great deal of time into both the prioritization and the budget reduction package. We talk sometimes about government wanting to operate like a business. Okay, if you had a business that had to readjust because of something, you could make that business immediately more profitable by cutting marketing and cutting research and development. On the other hand, that would start the death spiral so that eventually the business wouldn't exist. So you would expect these type of priorities should be done in a pretty strategic fashion. And I'm assuming that you've done that with a lot more thought and energy and time than we can probably put into it. Where the question comes, and I'm looking, for example, your priorities don't follow necessarily that the number one priorities get the smallest cuts, the four priorities get the largest cuts, because you've obviously been more strategic than that. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering, though, is if we use your model, and then 10% is just a yardstick, if we have to adjust that to a 6% cut or a 12% cut, do we follow your cut package in making those adjustments, or do we follow your priorities?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's quiet on my right here, so I'll jump in. And Representative Hansen, I appreciate your comments, because that was a major concern. If we had to look at where we've been, where we are, where we want to be 5 years from now. I mean, we don't want to lose some of the key things. We don't want these programs that are so critical to kids to yo-yo up and down to some extent. So basically, the numbers you see in our reduction list reflect the importance and we can make that work, and that a commitment that we can make that work if that has to be. But I would suggest then that based that is the consensus of all of those stakeholders, that if it's something less than that it should probably be spread proportionally based on that list. Does that answer your question?
Proportionately, regardless of classification, priority?
Yes.
Well, that undermines the entire process that we're trying to accomplish by having priorities. I mean, the governor has the ability to say, okay, we're going to do a 5% cut without having a special session across the board, which then penalizes those that are most successful in the greatest priority when they may be hurt the most by it, and it enables those that have the least priority and may have the least outcomes. And so what we're really trying to accomplish is to go to an outcome-based system based on priorities, where if we start running out of money, the major cuts come from the bottom of the list because they're the least important when compared to all of them, that not all priorities are equal, and it's not going to be, you know, about making it palatable to the people in the various priorities because everybody took a hit. We're really trying to say from the standpoint of the citizens, that which is least essential gets cut first or gets cut hardest. So would you mind, we've heard about 1 and 2, would you go back to priorities and tell us how you placed your categories into those that are like 3, 4, and 5, the lowest categories? What was that also just kind of a consensus thing that was developed, or was there actual criteria?
Mr. Chair, before we leave that, I think I want to clarify. I think what I heard was that the question of if the cuts are more or less than 10%, the answer was if they're less than 10%, then the reductions would be proportionate to, but in the same manner as the reduction list that they've identified, not reductions across the board,
right,
but where, for example, they took 5%
right
out of the local funding streams. If you only had to take 5% overall, then you'd take 2.5% out of those local funding streams.
Okay.
That's
so
correct.
Thank you. All right, I see.
I'm sorry.
I'm reading and listening. So but anyway, thank you for the clarification. The other
hand on
your shoulder. Oh, Susan. Senator Bates.
I think something I want to comment on has already been answered here. I think your cut list does represent your priorities, and we understand that. At least I understand it. I hope I do anyway. I wish the problem we're facing was where to put the 10% increase we're offering you and where you thought you would go with it.
Yeah, that's right. Wouldn't that be?
But that's not what we're doing. I think it's very difficult for this group of legislators in a week or 2 weeks to look at something as complex as this to make suggestions to you how to deal with this problem. So I think we're going to be probably going to be following your lead on it, although that will be up to other members of this commission. One of the things I'd like to see in this list, though, which makes it more real to me, is we're looking at cuts based on continuing service level, whether you like to use that phrase or not. And I'd like to have LFO put in this column next to it what the 0305 actuals were, mm-hmm, actuals in the program versus what the cuts represent. Are we looking at a 2 or 3% increase in certain areas, a decrease in certain areas of real money? So it would make it much more realistic to me so I can understand this better. Because you're looking at these cuts, but it doesn't really tell you what's going into a program at that point. And so if you could include information in the spreadsheet, it would help us a great deal. Maybe the commission can do it, or you can do it, Sheila.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, the commission has provided that level of detail, and so when we, to me, and so when we get there, I can certainly make that available to you as well. It shows history, in fact, since 0103,
right,
to show what's happened to the various funding streams over time.
The other comment I'll make is one that still concerns me, and it goes back to what we talked about earlier. I haven't seen the outputs discussed, and that was what I was looking forward both the most to in the last 5 or 6 days. I mean, we all love babies, we all love kids, we all want things to be better for these families. I wanted to look at some actual outputs, and I haven't heard that from this group, and I haven't heard for 5 years. And I'd like to have that discussion sometime. We haven't got time now, and I appreciate that. We've got to form a budget. But 2 years from now, we'll be back. Please, let's look at the outputs, the real outputs, and make those numbers real so you know how you're doing, and we know how you're doing. And maybe we can talk about better funding for certain programs. Maybe we can move some things forward. I'm just very disappointed that those outputs were not available to us in a group setting.
Certainly, it's an issue because at the end of this meeting, I mean tonight, we have to look at the Commission on Children and Families, determine what the priority is going to be, and then we're going to set that aside and listen to another 5 weeks of other programs, and then at the end of that, go back and look at 100 programs or 44 plus sub-programs, and then do some prioritization with the limited amount of funds. And so part of this decision is based on what we're hearing, and I feel somewhat inadequate in making such important decisions that are going to affect lives without further input. That's why I'm trying to push this forward, to get your input on the 10% and the priorities. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible, are there like summaries available of the FMORS database that you refer to?
Yeah.
And would that be helpful if we could see that? I don't know how extensive that is, but would that give us more of the... If we had a chance to peruse that and in some areas, would that give us more specific data?
Yes, I believe that it would, Representative Hansen, Chair Richardson. I believe that it would give you a little more detail on what it is the Commission's measuring and how those outcomes have played out, at least for this biennium. Mm-hmm. So we could make that available to you.
I think that would be helpful. The other thing I just want to make as a quick comment is that this is a relatively small budget in relationship to the next one we're going to look at. And I don't want to make any real hard choices on this until I see the interrelationship between this budget and DHS. And I'm thinking there very well are some program areas that are so interrelated and stuff that we're going to have to make some budgetary decisions based on that interrelationship rather than mm-hmm. what we're seeing just here.
And certainly one was brought up about federal pre-kindergarten Head Start and and the relationship between that and Healthy Start. Senator Carter first.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just a comment to the committee. You remember the old story about the fox in the hen house and how he snoops around and everybody think he's protecting the hens, then all of a sudden he bite him. There he is, right there, sitting in front of us. And I don't blame them. This program has been very smart. They have Dr. Henry, they have Dr. Wright, and then they have the fox sitting right there, smiling in front of our face. And I don't blame them about not wanting us to prioritize for them. And John has been a person that we've been able to trust over the years, even though I know legislators want to be able to make some decisions. Well, I don't blame them for saying, just give us a general cut. If you don't give us a cut, let us do our own prioritizing within the framework of our program. And if Representative Hansen, we're going to respect the intelligence of these people, I think it's nice to look at the performance measures, and if they're not performing in a particular area that they say they're going to perform in, is it one of those 10-year ventures that we're looking at, and we're going to base our funding of this program again based upon what do you want to see in 10 years, 5 years, or do you want to just take it where it is on, from the time that they have been in office and these performance measures have been in place? All of this is collaborative thinking that has to take place within a framework of our committees. If indeed we want to do that, or do we want to trust the fact that the Fox is on the board and is helping to direct their attention? I don't think he's smiling, but I don't think he's that soft-hearted when it comes to money that he's not going to help direct in a positive direction. Because he knows, I don't mind coming back to him to talk about something they said they were going to fulfill, then they don't fulfill it. So it's our decision, what we want to do. I don't care how many questions you ask them. The thing is that how do we want to determine, based upon these priorities, or, and I think it's a question for the committee, do we want to go that direction, or do we want to say, take your 10%, go forth, do good, and here's the thing that we want to see happen.
Okay. Senator Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That gives me a lot to think about, and if you're characterizing Mr. Juncker as the Fox, I know you do that with love. And the I just look at him in awe and characterize him as perhaps the best budgeteer that ever walked into this building, and that's in a long list of very capable people.
That's right.
So thank you for your service. And if, as Representative Hansen says, this is a small package, well, small budget, all I can say is that God's gifts come in small packages, and that the work you do is incredible. And I think that's part of the problem we're having, Representative Bates's accurate concerns. You know, show us the measurements, show us the outcomes. And you're trying to put, you know, all of the individual creativity that the counties and the local commissions have in these silo, you know, outcomes. And I don't say that as an excuse. I just say that, you know, as a reason. And, you know, you've got to do better on that. We've got to help you, but it's a very difficult task. And it's the last thing I think we want to do as a committee is stifle what the local commissions do. And that's, I think, part of the problem when we sit behind these dioceses and, you know, try to look at cookie cutter budget presentations. And the last thing I want to say is, as I go through this and we immerse ourselves in it, and we have, there are several of us up here that have just been living, breathing, eating this for a number of days. And what occurs to me, and I just say this as a comment, I don't need a response, Mickey. But as I look at that germ of genius that you all plant in each of the counties, I mean, that's the strength of your program. And I look at these, you know, round numbers, you know, $45 million general fund and $23 million Fed funds. And I wonder how much creativity is stifled by the golden chains that bind that $23 million dollars of federal funds in the Healthy Start program, and how much more you could do with those general funds if they were unencumbered. I don't have an answer to that. I just want to say that as a general comment. And I don't know if there's a way to uncouple that. And if some counties want to go ahead, you know, and use, you know, the existing delivery stream of Healthy Start and federal dollars, and others don't. I don't know if there's a way to do that, but I think that's something that we as a committee should look at, Mr. Chair.
Well, I fully agree that flexibility is the key to versatility and success based on local needs and local solutions. Can you, Mickey, just answer this for me? And when you came to the determination for levels 3, 4, and 5, were they basically also reached by consensus, like 1 and 2? I mean, the group got together and said, you know, this is kind of more important than these, and then you kind of said, okay, now we've got a line here, and this is 2, and then this will be 3 or 4. Is that basically what happened?
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, that's basically, I would say that we spent the most time with 1 and 2. Right. And the reason being, and I just want to be as clear as I can about the criteria, we didn't have a long list of criteria. It was actually very short. Number one, we wanted to keep a 36-county system viable. Right. For local decision making. And number two, we wanted to keep those essential components of a child abuse prevention program viable. Even though they were number two, it was absolutely essential that we keep all seven relief nurseries, that we have Healthy Start in 36 counties, and that we have CASA in 36 counties. But we took it a step further. That budget committee that was made up of six local commission members, two small, two medium, two large, a CASA person, a Healthy Start person, a relief nursery person, state commissioner, state staff, local staff, together we have addressed all of the issues that we could possibly imagine that we needed to take into consideration. And so what that group's going to do is they're going to continue. Is there a way we can regionalize some of these efforts? How do we more closely connect Healthy Start and Relief Nurseries? Again, how do we maximize the use of the dollars? And what I want to say to you is our system is different. We are about mobilizing and supporting all those other services. We don't provide direct services. We leverage the community support. Some people could ask you.
Mickey, okay. I got you.
All right.
We've got 15 minutes. At 25 after, I would like to turn time over to Dr. Henry for some closing remarks, and then I would also like to have a minute of that 5 minutes for some closing remarks with the committee. So we have 15 minutes, and I'd like to spend that on the 10% reductions. Okay, just so hopefully John will be a part of that. We want to spend this 15 minutes on the 10% reductions. So, but before that, Representative Hannah.
Well, that's a great lead-in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to get to some specifics, and so correct me if this
Please
is not
do,
the
no,
wrong
this
time,
is
but
the
this
time.
Is a 10% reduction. As someone mentioned, we've been living and breathing this information, and so I want to understand more fully how this would work. And an example of that would be, as we look through the programs, one of the priority level three items is the juvenile crime prevention funds. As I look through the primary purpose or activity coding, one of those is a level five, which is criminal justice. It's the only program within your grouping that's part of what looks like criminal justice. So I look back to the 10% reduction impact of reduction, and it talks about staff reductions would result in suspension of JCP evaluation activities and so forth. And I say to myself, as you had this committee together and you ranked this as a number three item, and it's the only item within your budget that has criminal-based element, I mean, does that committee sit down and say, maybe this should be with the youth authority? And rather than thinning the soup, should we hand it to another group who would take that without reduction?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, as I stated before, this should be up within our cluster of number one. It should not be number three. We did not have the substantive discussion around this. We did have the substantive discussion about where these funds should go with the governor's office, with Oregon, and with Oregon Youth Authority. And one of the reasons why they're with the commission, the governor's office chose to move them to us, is because they are really prevention grants that go to counties. They are about prevention, not about beds. So it's trying to get on the front end of that juvenile crime piece. And they should be in the number one cluster. So I just want to say we should have put it there. That's where we want it to be, and that's where we're staying to you. Because those funds go to local communities, so they make decisions locally about what needs to occur. Does that answer your question, Representative Hannah?
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. How would you like to proceed as we look at the 10%? Are there things that you would like to point out? Could you explain to me if we had to make only one 10% cut, and I'm looking at this four-page chart, would I, in your recommendation, if I had to only cut certain amounts of money, would I start at the very end of this back, or would I start at number one on page one because that is the where you think the first cut would come from? Not trying to prioritize the cuts if they have to come.
Okay, I'm Chair Richardson and members of the committee. If we go back the way, again, we looked at this, and if you look at what is under 3 and 4, all of those funds are federal funds.
Pass-through federal funds? I'm looking at 3 and 4. I see, I don't see it under federal funds.
Oh.
Well, two of them have federal funds.
I'm sorry.
I see some, but I'm still seeing general fund column with
right.
some money in it.
You want this? Here, just use my phone. Just have you use my
phone. New initiatives.
Next page.
Chair Richardson. Okay. I think I'm finally on the same page. Of course, we put. Should I start with number 5?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
Within the commission's budget, we put a policy package in for one FTE to work with the Oregon Department of Education around community schools. That is just an FTE we asked for. It would not have any general fund attached to it. It would be paid for with other dollars. So if we were to start reducing something, if it's not, we're looking at how many dollars that would be the first place we would go in terms of a new initiative.
Okay.
Okay.
And then would you just kind of work your way from the back up?
We'd work our way from the back up.
With the possible exception of the top of that page, which is juvenile crime prevention, which you now say is really a number one?
Is really a number one. Yes.
Okay. Members of the committee, are there questions you have on the 10% cuts that have been proposed and anything about the priorities or the cuts that you'd like to have brought up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's back to my point earlier. Maybe I was not as descriptive as maybe I should have been for trying to give compliments to the organization for which these people are put together. But if we're talking about prioritizing general fund dollars, is what we have not made clear to them. If we're talking about prioritizing general fund dollars as opposed to other funds or federal funds, then I don't see anything in terms of their general funds that are up for cuts. It's federal funds that are up for cuts.
I believe that the criteria that they were given was that they needed to come up with 10% cuts in each of the categories, general fund, federal fund, other funds, so that kind of... Excuse.
See, to me, categories refer to programs as opposed to program dollars.
That's interesting, but I think that they were talking about program
how you
dollars.
Is that it when you guys were prioritizing? That's what I was talking about.
Okay.
Okay.
Comment.
Okay.
I need to clarify that.
Yeah.
Sheila's just telling me. I'm just looking at it a little differently now, so it is general fund cuts. I just didn't get to the right page.
Okay. All right, did you have another comment?
I was going to just tell them how smart they were. I was cut federal, too.
They are smart.
Mr. Chair, if I could...
Please.
If Mickey could talk a little bit about how... In the youth investment programs and the family preservation programs, although those are passed through federal monies that the commission gets, if you could talk a little bit about the source of those funds and the potential for other uses of those funds, if indeed there were reductions in those funding streams. Because it, on the face of it, when we're looking at other funds and federal funds cuts, it may not make sense, but in these two instances, I believe that those monies could be used in other places of either this commission's budget or in other human services budgets. And if you could talk about that a little bit.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, Sheila, let me make sure you wanted me to talk about the youth investment and the family preservation and support funds.
Those funds, are they funneled through DHS?
Both of those dollars come through DHS to us.
Would they be available if they were cut here to be utilized in DHS programs or other programs?
Yes, they would, except the Family Present Support Funds, that was the original name of the act. It's now the Adoption and Safe Family Act, has two components to it. It's 4B1 and 4B2. The 4B2 component was more about having community supports in place to help families before children got removed from the home. So there was a specific reason. It was to provide counseling, all kinds of support services to families so that they would not have their children removed from the home. Originally, when that particular act was passed in 1995, they had to have, the Department of Human Services needed to have a planning component for the part two of that federal funding stream. So part one was for services that they provided at the Department of Human Services. Part two was really for planning around being able to have other community supports. So that's why the commission got those funds in the first place, is because we were in the process of doing, looking at the community, what are the gaps, needs, etc. We actually, DHS, when they first applied for those funds, didn't get them.
Just because of time, let me ask you a question.
I'm sorry.
If these two funds, these are 4B2 money funds, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And they were given to the commission because the commission is going to be focusing those funds on local level or on the families. So if they were to be cut, are you saying that that money might be available to DHS for other similar kinds of uses, but there are some restrictions on the use?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Other questions on, could you lead us through this? Are there other things that we need to be focusing on that you've seen in your analysis?
Well, I think the only other question that I would ask is a similar question on the child care and development funds. Again, these are federal funds that are passed through a different agency, in this case, Department of Employment. They come to the commission for a specific purpose, but the question would be, again, it's a targeted purpose, but would there be some reason or consideration of using those funds differently?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, those funds come to us from the federal government, and we here in Oregon decide who is going to use them for what purposes. The purposes from the feds is very broad. And so we have a particular use at the commission, quality and availability of child care. If we no longer had those funds, they could go back to the Employment Department or to the Department of Human Services, again, depending upon what the use would be.
Okay. Representative Hannah.
Thank you. When we look at the specifically those two, just because they're a good example, help us to understand when it shows that 100% of the funds are passed through to the local commissions and we see no reduction in FTE, is that at the state level, or does that include when that reduction gets passed through to the local commissions?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, those funds are 100% passed through the commission, so there are no, or to locals, so there are no state FTE. An analysis was not done of any impact that cuts may have on FTE in communities. It wouldn't be county staff. It would be actually program or service provider staff.
Will we get to that level? I mean, will we understand that as we go?
Yes. We will make sure that we can get to that level and that you can understand that when we get to that level.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to direct your attention on page 2 of the 10% cuts at the very bottom where it talks about Healthy Start. And it says, you know, Healthy Start kind of explains what it is. And then it says General Fund $3,370,000. And then other funds, $675,000. I don't know where those numbers came from. Is this a part of Healthy Start that would be considered, or is this a little more than 10% or 15% of the total general fund Healthy Start budget? I mean, my recollection, I can look it up, but I think it's like $23 million for Healthy Start, and then here it's talking about $3.37 million.
I'm sorry, Chair Richardson, which page are or which worksheet are you referring to?
I'm looking at the 10% cuts,
right here.
And it's
right here.
Page 204.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, okay. Thank you. Chair Richardson and members of the committee, the number that is impacted in the other funds is actually Medicaid administration. Local Healthy Start programs have the ability to participate in the Medicaid administration program for Title 19. So some of the work that the commission or that the Healthy Start providers are doing in the homes is eligible for reimbursement through the Medicaid program at a 50-50 match. So as we reduce, if we reduce this piece here is reflective of a reduction in general fund will reduce their capacity to claim reimbursement, and it's more than 10%. Is that
right?
Okay. So that's where this 675 number comes from.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Senator.
I understand the Medicaid program, what it does, and that these are some healthcare-related services, I'm assuming. Is there another delivery system that could deliver those services to these parents that would then free up these dollars for you to use in other areas? I mean, if we're getting Medicaid match and the feds are paying for 50% of it, is there a way we can fund shift to give you more flexibility, provide the service, maybe not through your Healthy Start, field rep, but make sure the parents, and obviously specifically the child, is getting that service? You don't have to answer that. Think about
that. Yeah, I will.
That's how I think.
Okay.
Imagine that if cuts were implemented, that would be the thought process all across the cuts.
Yeah.
Well, on this very same track, if that service was provided through the federally qualified primary care clinics, could we tell what the match would be if we were expanding their role to deliver the Healthy Start services?
That would take some thought.
Okay.
I can certainly think on that and get back to you in a few days.
We have a lot to digest. We may have some additional questions individually. If so, we'll give you a call, Mickey. Appreciate so much all the time and effort that you and all of your staff and associates have placed in presenting to us this week. If we could hear from Dr. Henry for a moment, we'd appreciate any closing remarks you might have as the chair of the commission.
Thank you, Chairman Richardson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Over the past 2 days, I hope we've clearly described, and clearly can be underlined, described the commission system and its unique model. We're the only, and I put state agency in quotation marks because we are a little bit more than that, mandated to create a framework that helps communities address their own local concerns. This means that rather than offering the take two aspirin and call me in the morning solutions, we provide guidance and tools. Let me briefly summarize some key points. We are about a framework for preventing child abuse. We are about a framework for helping communities help themselves. We are about a framework for leveraging. By providing the frameworks to leverage volunteer efforts, to leverage financial donations, the State Commission helps energize public-private partnerships, maximizing the power of contributions. I also would like to add that we have heard you. This is an iterative process. And what I've heard from you over the last 2 days has to deal with, we need to do some things better, and I've listed four of them, and let me see if I've gotten them right. We need to address issues of leadership and mobilization that were raised by Senator Carter. We need to address issues of outcomes that were raised by Senator Bates and Representative Hanna. We need to address issues of flexibility that was raised by Senator Westland and Representative Richardson. We need to address issues of coping that were raised by Representative Richardson, Senator Westland, and, in fact, most of the members of the committee. I believe we have established that there is an important thing going on here, and we appreciate the help that you've given us. We look forward to further collaboration and work together, and we really feel that you are working with us, and we've appreciated the input that you've given us, and we look forward to going forward with this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all you're doing.
Senator
Carter.
Sam, would you think about when you look at general funds versus federal funds, how sometimes you're tied, how your federal, your general fund dollars are tied in a way that you can't get to them in a way which you'd like to because of the federal funds that determines how you use those dollars? Because and so is it better to not have the federal funds in order for you to do more what you want to do at local levels with the general fund? So just think about it. Nobody want to ever lose money, but think about your cause and what you're doing.
Thank you.
That's a lot nicer.
Oh, you did ask.
Very nice.
But I'm, you know.
Thank you. Before we conclude, committee members, I'd like to hand out to you a form that I'm going to be using. Senator Carter, can I give you a copy of this as well? And this is a form that I prepared that I'm going to be using in evaluating each of the programs as we go through the next 6 weeks to try and give a ranking of on questions that were important to me that I've kind of put down at the bottom there, so that when we have to actually set the priorities, if we listen to 40 presentations, it's hard to know what number 3 was all about unless we evaluate it at the time that we're hearing it, and then we review our notes and go back at the time that we're being called upon to do an entire prioritization. So anyway, I just thought I would share that with you if it's any value to anyone else. And appreciate your intuitive remarks and comments and questions, and for the support and that the communities have shown for the Commission on Children and Families and the work that you're doing, because truly the work that you are doing is in the homes of the people and in the communities where they live, and it's where the rubber meets the road, where the real action is taking place. And I know that the funding is not going to change the desire that you have to make a difference in the lives of families and children, but it certainly makes the capacity a lot better. And so we'll keep that in mind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further comment? We're adjourned.